You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk about NPR's Community Conversation, A Nation Engaged, looking at the big issues facing Wisconsin and the Milwaukee area.
Right now, a new paper in Science breaks down what researchers learned from a pair of fossilized tomatillos from Argentina. They're part of the nightshade family, which also includes edible plants like tomatoes, along with the deadly poison belladonna.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now to break down this and other science news. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and happy 2017 to all of you.
Happy 2017 to you, too. Well, we've got some tomatillos here to start out with, some very, very old tomatillos, it turns out. So what's exceptional about these?
Yeah, you don't want to be putting these in your salsa, trust me. Yeah, so this is an amazing find. They found in Argentina these two absolutely beautifully preserved fossilized tomatillos. And if you're not a huge tomatillo fan, you've seen them in the supermarket. You've had them in your salsa verde. They look like tomatoes wearing these little paper jackets called husks. And basically, the husks were perfectly preserved. I mean, seriously, they look like something you'd find in maybe your compost bin last week. And one of the cherries within, or one of the berries within the husk was still preserved as well. And the thing is, these tomatillos are 52.2 million years old. And that is a huge thing because we don't know that much about how the nightshade family developed. And, you know, you mentioned nightshades include tomatoes and tomatillos and belladonna, but they also include potatoes and eggplant and peppers and tobacco even and petunias. I can't forget the petunias. So it's a huge, huge family of plants, but we really had very little information about when they evolved. And based on the scant information we had and doing some modeling, they thought that nightshades had evolved 35 to 51 million years ago, like 51 was the upper limit for nightshades. But these tomatillos, again, are 52.2 million years old. And tomatillos are some of the younger nightshades, the last to evolve. So nightshades must be tens of million years older than we thought.
Right, because if there are these tomatillos 52 million years ago, they're probably their cousins that eventually led up to the petunias and the eggplants and the other stuff, and it must have taken a long time for those to split off from the same common ancestor.
Absolutely. I mean, they didn't want to speculate on how far back nightshade evolution started based on these fossilized tomatillos, but it seriously, it has to be tens of millions of years before we thought it was, which is, it's always exciting when you find that big of a difference. And when you find it based on evidence that is pretty clear, it's very well dated. So it's not like they're guessing. They can be very sure that these tomatillos are indeed that old.
And Gemma, this inspired you to do some cooking with tomatillos. Did you feel any differently about them than you might have before, knowing how ancient their roots are?
I did. And, you know, I have to say, the first year I lived in my house, I planted tomatillos just to see what would happen. And these things were like predators. They took out my cucumbers. They went mano a mano with my tomatoes. And the next year, I didn't plant them, but they came back.
Wow.
It's funny because, yeah, tomatillos are kind of like this invasive monster in my garden every year now. And now, you know, I now have a freezer full of them, but I'm going to give them a little more respect. You know, they may have coexisted with the dinosaurs. Who knows?
Before we move on, Gemma, for studying the evolution of animals, we leave things like bones and teeth around that make it easy to study. For plants, is it pretty rare to find something like a 50-million-year-old piece of fruit?
Yeah, it depends, especially for like fruits and the flowers. That's very rare just because, you know, they're more delicate, they're more water-based, they degrade faster. So you'll find, you know, the hard seeds, for example, or even pollen, but it is very rare to find plants, the actual berries and the paper husks this old.
We're talking with Gemma Tarlak right now, senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She's with us with some of the coolest news from the world of science. And Gemma, there has been some persistent thinking about the human brain and the size of human teeth, and that was the brains got bigger, and so our teeth could get smaller because we didn't need to tear stuff up with our teeth so much because we could make tools and do other sophisticated things. What's this new study about?
Yeah, this is really interesting because it kind of like the tomatillos, it really rewrites what we thought we knew about this particular topic. And in this case, you know, absolutely, like you said, we've long thought that our brains got bigger and our teeth got smaller because with our big brains, we could figure out how to make stone tools that sliced and diced. We could figure out how to make a fire to cook our food over so it wasn't so hard to chew. So that has long been the assumption. Bigger brains and smaller teeth kind of went hand in hand in evolutionary terms. However, this team looked at several different hominin species. They looked at Australopithecus, which of course predates our own genus, but they also looked at the Homo genus, as well as two members of Paranthropus, which is kind of like an offshoot of the hominids that very distantly related to the Homo genus. And they looked at all of the skulls and the tooth size and the brain size and shape. And what they figured out was the teeth kind of got smaller at a steady rate. That was pretty much across the record the same thing. And the brain size, brain shape can be an indicator of cognitive function. They found the brain shape changed, but again, pretty much at a steady rate, not as steady as the teeth. But when then they looked at brain size, and they saw that there was really no correlation between brain size growth and tooth size shrinkage. So there would be these spurts of brain growth, but they were not reflected in the teeth shrinkage at the same rates. So it's very interesting and kind of flies in the face of what we thought we knew.
So that means what? We need a new explanation for why the teeth are getting smaller?
Well, yeah, and you know, the researchers, they were not about to say confidently, this means this, and, you know, settle the debate. This is just another round in an ongoing debate. But basically, they think that there are a lot of different environmental factors about teeth size, you know, in terms of what's available to eat, the kind of environment you're living in, all these different elements. And that is separate from brain size, because brain size is, of course, impacted by the environment you're in, but it's also impacted by things like, are you living in a social group? You know, there are all these different other things. So they think they're two separate, mostly separate factors that impact brain size and tooth size.
And you're right about how it is pretty striking. If you were to line up a human or even an older human than we are today with a bonobo or a chimpanzee, the teeth size is pretty different.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you go to the paper, and there's a link on my blog to it where you can read the paper for yourself and see the actual comparisons of, you know, the different sizes of the molars, and it's absolutely striking. And there were a lot of theories, everything from, well, say chimpanzees need much larger molars because they do a lot more chewing of fibrous plants, whatever. There are a lot of theories in that direction, but for a long time, we really thought that the smaller teeth were tied to the bigger brains, and now that's not the case.
Let's move on to some more research. This one from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, looking at dinosaur eggs. First of all, dinosaurs, 65 million years ago, they ended, so they could have been munching on tomatillos the whole time. Because this shakes up our picture of what kind of salsa dinosaurs might have made and eaten. But this new research focusing on dinosaur eggs.
Yes. Specifically what was inside the dinosaur eggs, and specifically the jaws of the embryonic dinosaurs. Our CT scanning has gotten so good, such high resolution, that they were able, for the first time ever, this has been done, to look inside the eggs at the teeth of the developing dinosaur embryos and actually find these things called von Ebner lines. And they're basically like tree rings for teeth, except they're daily. Any animal that has teeth, as it develops, every day it gets like another von Ebner line on its teeth. And so they were able to see these superfine lines in the teeth of the embryonic dinosaurs. And that just blows my mind in and of itself, that they were able to actually see lines on something that, you know, went extinct 65 million years ago. That's crazy. But then what they saw in the lines has changed what we thought about how long dinosaur eggs had to be, you know, how long it took for them to hatch. And basically, we thought dinosaur eggs were probably similar to birds, because birds are, after all, living dinosaurs. But birds have a very fast incubation period. So they lay their eggs, little bit incubation, eggs hatch, and boop, little birdie, born into the world. Huzzah. We thought that's what dinosaurs did too. But they found out looking at these von Ebner lines and the dinosaur embryos and basically counting them, that dinosaurs have an incubation period, the eggs, of about 3 to 6 months. And that's more than twice as long as birds. It's a lot longer than some species of birds. And what does this all mean? Well, it means that more time of the dinosaur's life cycle is spent incubating in an egg. So it makes them a little less efficient, and they think when the great mass extinction event happened about 66 million years ago at the end of the Cretaceous, they think that maybe dinosaurs had a harder time surviving it because it was taking them so long. Their life cycle took just a little bit longer, which affected the number of eggs that would hatch, which affects the survival rate of the baby and juvenile dinosaurs. It's super exciting stuff, but it's very early. I want to caution people that this is not carved in stone, because the two dinosaur eggs, the two species of dinosaur eggs they looked at, they're both ornithischian dinosaurs. And these are herbivores, kind of the cows and sheep of the Cretaceous. They don't have any eggs, to my knowledge, certainly not in this study, but we don't have any eggs that are really well preserved but belong to the super fast predators along which the bird line evolved. So maybe if we found some of those dinosaurs, the theropods, which were predatory and a lot more faster and agile, maybe we would see more bird-like incubation rates.
All right, so this is exciting stuff, but it's early. Are we likely to find one of these eggs of these really speedy predator dinosaurs so we can put some of this to bed a little?
Yeah, you know, we have found eggs from theropods. I don't believe they are as well preserved as these. And really, the scope of this study was just to see, can we even find the von Ebner lines? And they did, which is phenomenal. So now that they've been successful in figuring out the incubation periods of these two herbivorous ornithischian dinosaurs, I bet you any money they are going to be scouring museum collections all over the place looking for well-preserved theropod eggs that have already been found. And, you know, the next paleontological find is just a dig away. It could be right under the surface, under our feet. So maybe this summer they'll find one. Who knows? But it's just exciting that they have proven that they're able to even count the von Ebner lines, to find them, number one, and to find them at such a high resolution that they can count them and determine the incubation period.
Gemma, thanks a lot for joining us, as always.
Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joined us to break down some of the coolest news from the world of science.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out what NPR's political correspondent Don Gagne is hearing from Americans in the lead-up to Inauguration Day. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.